This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Dr. Lyle. How are you doing today?
Good. Good to be here.
Excellent. Well, you know, the previous shows that we've had, we've been talking about different evolutionary psychology as it pertains to relationships and love and sex and dating and all kinds of different topics. And today I thought we would just learn a little bit more about you and your experiences as a psychologist for the criminal justice system. Now, you used to work in Dallas, Texas. Is that right? Tell us about that.
Yes. I was the psychologist. I was the in-house psychologist for the adult probation department. And so I worked as the, I was actually all by myself. I was the only guy. And I did evaluations for the courts for both the criminal and, the felony and the misdemeanor courts. And for people that were on probation. And this is where the judges would, you know, they would be looking at a situation and they were trying to figure out what should be done with some individual, and they would get sent to me, and then I would give them my opinion. That was very interesting work.
Yeah, and so these people, were they violent offenders, or I mean, was it kind of everything out there that you could think of?
Yeah, I would say it was all kinds of stuff. So it was men, women. The women were rarely having anything to do with violence. It's mostly men. Men are about 93% of the people that are incarcerated, and things with the men were violent in one way or the other. A lot of them weren't. So a lot of them would have been drug crimes or some other, or stealing, that sort of thing. But certainly a fair amount of it is in some way some kind of violent problem. Yeah, so all kinds of different stuff, and my job would be to essentially figure out what the judge ought to be thinking about this person. Is this person a person of decent character that got into a set of tough circumstances, or this is a bad apple that I should throw the book at? And so that's the kind of questions essentially that I was being asked.
And it seems because nobody, I mean, were you talking to this with the court reporter, kind of talking to the judge, and the court reporter has to write down everything you say, or was this more like, you know, you just talk to him and kind of give him an honest opinion about, you know, what this criminal is?
Actually, what I would do is they would send the people to me, and I would know that what they were trying to figure out, and I would interview the individual, and then I would write a report. So
okay.
I was occasionally called into court, not very often. And occasionally there would be a go-between. Probation officers that worked in the courts would ask me sort of on the side, well, you know, I know what your report says, but what do you really think? And that's how some informal communications would go on this way. It was I learned a great deal in doing this, and I actually learned some critical skills that would become important later in all kinds of situations, certainly in conflict resolution, and also and a key component of conflict resolution is in marital therapy or relationship therapy. Because that's a conflict situation where you're trying to resolve, but also in other conflict situations. And so I could actually describe for you how I learned this. It just occurs to me now that this might be interesting for people. Because it sets the stage for a very methodical and excellent technique for dealing with conflict resolution kind of situations. So let me describe how this came about, because it took me quite a while to evolve this technique, and then it wound up being useful much later when I did psychotherapy with, you know, normal people. A lot of times when people would come in, and I saw thousands of individuals in my time in Dallas, what I would do is I couldn't tell how bad of an apple they were. And it turns out that if they were 24 years old, for example, and they were in for some felonious thing, you didn't know, they might not have had much of a record. And on the other hand, they might not have been in Texas for that long either, so you don't know. And there wasn't a national database at that time. So, of course, the people don't know this. So the criminals don't know this. There was a little bit of national data, like, I don't know, FBI stuff, and we would certainly run that. But if some locale up in Oklahoma had a rap sheet on some guy, we would never know it. And so what I would do is I would play possum, and I would say things like, you know, I just sort of took a glance at your file, and, you know, I saw what you're on for. There's a whole big write-up in there. What sorts of things, when I look at this thing later, what sorts of things have you ever, you know, in other states or other locales, what sorts of things have you ever been arrested for? Okay. And I would just keep my mouth shut and act real casual, and I would watch them hesitate because they weren't sure what they could get away with or what they couldn't. And generally, they would spill it. And so this was a little acting job. And so then also another part of this information phishing that I would do is that I would the person would come in and essentially say that more or less they were innocent, and it was been blown out of proportion. And what I would do is I would actually do a technique that I would ultimately call crystal clear. And what crystal clear is that we just keep asking questions until we have it crystal clear, until every little thing makes sense. Like, well, you know, it wasn't even my car, and then they pulled me over. You know, of course I was on probation, and I didn't know there's guns in the trunk, and, you know, it's my cousin's, right? So then what we do is we back up from there and we say, well, where were you going? And, you know, how did you come to have the car keys? And how is it that you weren't driving some different car? Were you driving the car instead of your cousin? And, you know, what was happening at that time, et cetera? Did you know that your cousin had anything to do with guns or they even had them, et cetera? So we asked all these tiny little questions. And about this time, I would probably been on the job for a couple of years. And I happened to read a book. I had read, obviously being interested in criminal psychology as I was, I had read Helter Skelter by Vincent Bugliosi. If nobody has read it, if people have not read it, and you have any interest in criminal behavior, Helter Skelter is the book of the Manson murders, and by the guy who prosecuted and solved the Manson murders, which was Vincent Bugliosi. And it's a hell of a book. And so I was very interested then a few years later when Vincent Bugliosi published a book called And the Sea Will Tell, which was an extraordinary murder case where he was on the other side. He was the defense attorney for a woman who was being prosecuted for murders that took place on an island called Palmyra, which is south of Hawaii, in this very lonesome, brutal place where she and her lover were there on their boat, and then there was another couple that came with a much, much nicer boat. And her lover killed these two people, and it actually it wasn't found out for very many years later when their bones washed up on the shore, 10 years or 15 years later. It was an incredible case. Any rate, it turns out that this woman was totally innocent and had no idea that this had happened, and the and her lover was absolutely psychopathic, and it's an extraordinary story of how Bugliosi goes through all these tiny, very incidental issues, questions on every little detail, and would make sure that everything made complete sense to him. And then when he could reproduce that thinking very carefully for the jury could see how every little strange thing fit into place and how this woman was actually innocent, even though all the prima facie evidence would have indicated that she was guilty. And I had no doubt when I was done with that book that she was completely innocent. And so Bugliosi discusses the concept of cross-examination and how cross-examination is a normal course of events in human life. So when, you know, the kid comes home late, you're like, well, where have you been? You know, that begins the cross-examination. And so we naturally do this, and people kind of get ready for it. But as we press people, if they're lying to us, they'll pretty quickly get on squishy ground where they'll start to gloss over details, and that is when we have to get crystal clear. So we have to know exactly why it is that they were thinking and doing what they were doing at that time, and that's what I would do with my probationers. So I got to practice what Vincent Bugliosi had talked about, and I would do this over and over again for hours a day with criminals that were trying to look like they were nicer people than they were, and that the reasons for their behavior were more benign than they were. And I have to say that very often they were right. So I can remember to this day some little sad sack woman that was on probation for, it was a felony of all things, for welfare fraud. And of course I'm looking at her and she's a pathetic looking thing. And I'm thinking, oh, is she some clever welfare queen who's taking 10 checks and all this? No, it wasn't anything at all. She was keeping her welfare while she was secretly working another job, and she had three children. And I have to tell you, I looked at that situation, I thought, you've got to be kidding me. Like, this is a crime? And I told her that this, I wouldn't have done it any different. And all I can tell you is you're not allowed to do this. And so you will see things in the criminal justice system that will make you shake your head and wonder at how people are mistreated by the system. And you'll also look at the criminal justice system when you see some real Lulus, and you'll say, thank God we've got prisons and we've got people that are willing to take the time to prosecute these people. So in any event, I spent years getting perfecting my determination to not let things slide when I don't quite understand something. And this evolves into what I call crystal clear. And so this then winds up being extremely useful in marital therapy, and it's very useful for people in a marital conflict when they are upset with each other, that I actually, if they're in the room with me and we're trying to talk something through, I explain to them that I want to have it exactly clear what everybody's thinking, which means I need one person to be quiet while the other person explains to me in perfect detail what their thinking is. And I will ask questions and ask questions and ask questions for reaffirmation until I get it exactly clear. And then I do something else, which is that I feed it back to that individual so that I explain to them, so you're thinking this because he said this, and then you're thinking that because he did that, and then you feel like this is the case, et cetera, et cetera. And I will get to the point where the person that's telling the story will have a tremendous sigh of relief, and they'll say, yes, that's exactly how I feel. So now they can relax because they understand that I have it exactly clear what it is that they are thinking and what they're feeling and why. Meanwhile, the other person's like ready to pee their pants because they're so upset because they want to interrupt, which they often do. And I have to tell them, don't interrupt. You know, you're going to, you know, get your chance to explain everything else on your side of the equation. And so we get completely crystal clear. The value of this is very often the person who's listening to this finds out that the other person is making inferences based on some incorrect information. And this winds up being unbelievably important. And so then when we switch hats and we go to the other side and then we meticulously go down through, we find the critical points where they disagree. This is the equivalent of the critical point where the criminal says, hey, this is the moment where I say I'm innocent, or they're glossing over the critical detail, but they really cannot explain the critical detail. And so this is precisely where we take out the magnifying glass, and we have to get it exactly clear what they were thinking and what they were doing, and how come the evidence says this, but you say that? How can we have the contradiction? And I would say that in almost every case, not every case, but almost every case, there was enough, there was either enough fuzziness on glossing over the details on the part of the criminal that I knew they were lying, or it was very clear that they had an alternative explanation for the pattern of evidence that actually was more plausible than the explanation that was given by the courts and given by the prosecutor, and that there had been they absolutely had an argument, and actually their argument made sense, and it actually fit the evidence better than any other alternative explanation, at which point I became convinced that their argument made perfect sense. And then, of course, it has to line up to their criminal history, et cetera. But this is where crystal clear gets very useful. And it gets very useful in the couples therapy, because as we get it very clear where the really key disagreements are, then we take out the magnifying glass and we get exceptionally clear on what those are. And then we're on fertile ground to essentially investigate and negotiate how that disagreement comes to be. I had a beautiful case. I'm just remembering now. This is about 15 years ago or so. So I had a guy who came in with his wife, and he was he said that he couldn't. She thought he was cheating on him, and then he said that he couldn't call her on his cell phone because the cell phone was given to him by his workplace. And I said, and the wife was absolutely insistent that she believed that he was cheating on her, and that he did not call her because he was off on his adventures with the other woman, and et cetera. Well, yeah, he was chipping on her. So I said, well, this shouldn't be a problem. All you have to do is we can solve this problem by simply getting another cell phone that's your private cell phone that isn't your work cell phone. And then when your wife calls your private cell phone, you can just answer anytime. Well, you should see the look on this guy's face. It was an instant checkmate. The wife was delighted. Nobody had thought of this. And he thought he had a foolproof. So then the most entertaining thing of all was they wind up divorced. And about 6 months or a year later, he drags in he had gone down with the ship and explained that, you know, it was all a mistake and it wasn't true and he wasn't cheating. So about 6 months or a year later, he drags in the girl that he was cheating with. I can't imagine how I kept my rapport with this guy, but I did somehow. And so anyway, he then is cheating with somebody else, and she suspects that he's cheating.
You're the only one who caught him. I mean, he got to have some credit for that.
This was an amazing case. And I can't remember what the particulars are of that thing, but the gal, of course, was very convinced that he was cheating. And, of course, she obviously watched this firsthand from the other direction. And anyway, that relationship also fell apart, but you know, we did what we could. So,
I'm curious, when you're in the couples counseling, do you tell them that you're using techniques that you learned in a criminal justice system to help them out?
No, I don't. It's actually a very benign version of the same thing, because, you know, we're not usually trying to catch, quote, lying. What we're really looking for is a difference of interpretation about something important and some central issue. And so when two honest, conflicted spouses come in and there's a lot of hurt feelings, this is exactly what we need to do, is we need to let everybody essentially understand more fully what's going on inside the other person's head. There is I believe that there is a program inside of human nature quite convinced of this, that says that if you're going to win an argument, you have to win it very fast, because it's going to be taking place in front of third parties in the village that aren't that interested. And as a result, you must win the argument very quickly. And you'll watch the human mind is well designed to essentially take an extreme polar position, that you're bad and I'm good and I'm honest and you're lying. And that this is, I've been egregiously treated, et cetera. And so this is the outrage and the accusation and the character assassination that goes on is pretty, this is normal state of affairs for humans. And they are very quick, and they're designed to be moving at 1,000 miles an hour mentally to try to quickly spot the flaw in any lying that goes on, which, of course, everybody's going to be shading the truth their direction, because if the other guy's shading the truth, then you have to shade the truth your way. There's an evolutionary arms race that's going on in this situation. So hyperbole and distortion wind up being essentially the soup of the day. And so this winds up being a very fast, ruthless poker game that goes on. And when couples try to resolve this, they're relying on the same Stone Age argument device, and it's not good. And so it's not very productive. It's not actually in the best interest of the relationship. It may have been effective in the Stone Age for making sure that you got at least an even break out of resource allocation disputes. But it winds up being pretty rough in relationships, and even the most mature, intelligent, wise people can very quickly get caught up into this, because it's a genetic program. So what we want to do is we want to know that program's in there, and we want to understand that what all the urgency that you feel is you're feeling a time pressure that our ancestors felt, that the audience isn't going to be very interested, and they're going to make up their mind pretty quickly on a superficial sample of the facts. And so what we want to do is we want to slow everybody down to about 10% of the speed that the argument device is working on. And sometimes when I'm in couples therapy, if someone begins, I cannot get the other person shut up because they're so upset. And so sometimes I'll have to take, one individual and say, look, they're just not able to be quiet. We'll come back to you. And I'll just shift over and let, motor mouth just spew because they can't stand it. And this is just the circuit that's going off, and they have to spin and spin and spin and spin and spin and spin and spin. It's very interesting that very often people will reiterate the same argument or the same grievance several times within, 7 minutes. They got to say it 3-4 times as if it's new evidence, and they want to make sure they hammer it in there. This is obviously a genetically embedded, rhetoric technique that sits inside of human nature. We slow it down. We ask the questions, we get crystal clear, and then we feed it back. When we do all those things, what happens is the relaxation on the part of the listener is profound. Okay, it is profound. The innocent man who I would cross-examine to crystal clear and actually has an explanation for why something happened that is very, very plausible and fits all the facts is absolutely relieved that I've taken the time and I've stepped through the evidence, and that everything, when I start to turn to the file and start to look through the file, when the guy was sitting right there, it turns out everything they say lines up and it's true. Okay? That's where you get to. That's where you want to get to in conflicts. And that's the beginning of the resolution of the conflict.
Now, so this is for the innocent people who are relieved that they're actually telling the truth and they've got somebody who's believing you.
Right.
It sounds too like you're kind of almost like interrogating them, but in a much more benign way, like a police officer would or a detective
yes.
would.
And
right. So have you ever had anybody turn violent or angry towards you because you've kind of stepped on, you've basically determined that they've had to admit that they're guilty?
Oh, no. No, I've never had that. With pretty violent, nasty people, I would make sure that I would, and this also winds up being very useful clinically in a number of ways. Let's suppose that I have someone who has some bizarre history one way or the other psychosocially. Like, for example, let's suppose that they think all the time about stabbing their mother to death. Okay, this is not out of bounds. There are people that have a lot of morbid thoughts. They don't have any morbid motivation. This is probably secondary, sort of an OCD like characteristic. And people with obsessive compulsive disorder, essentially by definition, massively overrate or overestimate the statistical likelihood of disaster. That's why they wash their hands 100 times a day. That's why they check the stove 50 times before they leave the house. They've got little open loops to the worst case scenario, and they're very imaginative, and they can imagine vividly these terrible things happening unless they take care of these things as best they can. And sometimes what they have is they have very morbid thoughts. They don't feel morbidly towards their mother. They just see a knife there, and it occurs to them that this could happen. Okay, and it's pretty awful for them to live with, and a lot of these folks they just live with it. But they recognize that this is sort of very embarrassing, and that people would freak out if they found out about it. So early in my career, when I had not run into this very often, but when people would admit things like this, it pays to be very nonchalant. And the experiences in working with criminals was very good, because you would hear and find out about some incredibly nasty things people had done, and your internal reaction is, oh my God, you SOB, unbelievable. And meanwhile, what you need to maintain is a nice, pleasant face that says, well, that's no big deal, okay? Well, what else? I mean, they gave you that sentence for that? That's pretty incredible. I can't believe how brutal it is, you know, in the system. Well, what else? I mean, what sorts of other things, you know, has come up? And you act very nonchalant, and then they spill it. And so this is acting nonchalant when things are actually disturbing or odd is a very useful technique in conflict resolution, because that's how people will feel more comfortable telling you more and more of the story, and you need to know more and more of the story, and we need to respect the fact that people are coming from their own position, and we need to understand it if we're going to get a resolution.
Hmm. Yeah. Never thought about it that way. I know that, like, I was backpacking, you know, hiking, and I'll stand at the edge of the mountain to kind of look at the edge, and I kind of, in my thoughts, I'm like, all right, don't fall over, don't jump over. Oh, if you did jump over, it'd probably be an interesting, you know, 5-second ride down. No, don't jump over. That doesn't mean I'm suicidal, right? It just means I'm kind of rehearsing through the scenarios that I don't want to get myself into.
Exactly.
And, sure. Yeah.
And there's people that essentially have those things 100 times more than you do.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when it comes to criminals, you know, what kind of, I know a few shows back, we talked about personality characteristics.
Yeah.
What you're saying, it sounds like this is an obsessive compulsive disorder would be very conscientious, but very open-minded individual.
Yeah, not necessarily open, but the OCD, the openness is independent of that the obsessiveness will cause them to be thinking about very low probability disasters, and they also tend to have a streak of emotional instability, so that when they imagine these rare events, they are upset about what they're imagining, and so as a result the internal experience is quite vivid and marked. And so, you know, this is just part of life. You know, there's people that, you know, we've all had, and we will all have some of these sort of bizarre way out thoughts will cross your mind as a possibility. But for somebody like myself, who's very boring and stable, and not that conscientious, these sorts of things are rare, but they do happen.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, and I'm curious, you know, with the criminals criminals in the criminal justice system, is there an overarching, you know, personality characteristic, pattern that you've observed?
Yes, that's a very good question, and people are people are inherently interested in criminals. The reason why I believe they're interested is because criminals are very biologically expensive. They are rule breakers in the village, and some of the rules that they break, they're essentially always directed at conflicts of interest between them and other people. They're either stealing from them, or they are essentially going to defend their status by beating the daylights out of them, or they're going to rape them. In other words, this doesn't just happen randomly. There's a cost-benefit analysis that we can all understand that's going on inside the criminal mind at the time that it's taking these actions. And so not quite understanding why they are not inhibited, but we would be inhibited under similar circumstances, this poses an important question for people who are of a non-criminal bent, because they want to understand how vulnerable they are and how they could theoretically protect themselves against such an individual. Because one of the things that you discover is that criminals are not behaving criminally all the time. In fact, they're behaving criminally a very, very small percentage of the time. So therefore, you could be in a relationship with someone who has a criminal bent, and you may not know it. So, or you may sort of ignore it because some of the signs of it are not directly impacting you. And then it turns out that you wind up being a victim. So this is, you know, a lot of women have wound up victimized by men that had these characteristics and were perfectly charming and pleasant and even exciting in the early going of a romance. And then it turns out that, we've got a conflict of interest now 6 months later, and they resolve that conflict in their own favor with violence and intimidation. So the primary individual difference variable that divides criminals from non-criminals is actually very simple and very basic and not very exciting or sexy, and that is just straight intelligence. So criminals are considerably less intelligent on average than normal people. Now they are not extremely low ability. So if you were to think of a bell curve of intelligence, with the mean or right in the middle of that bell curve is 100 IQ, and then if you go down a notch, lower to around 90, I think that's probably somewhere around maybe the 30th percentile or so. That is the typical criminal. Typical criminal behavior is taking place somewhere in from about the 5th percentile to the 30th percentile or so of human nature. Now, of course, what's exciting to people and gets written up are when criminals are very intelligent. And probably what's exciting about that is that when criminals are very intelligent, they are very, very scary because you can't see it coming. And therefore, people feel vulnerable, and therefore they're glued to their television sets to learn about cases where they can now learn something about how a smart person with a criminal bent could outwit them, and therefore they need to be sort of mentally prepared for that possibility. Those are rare. So most of the time, most criminals that you're going to find are sort of blue-collarish, you know, i.e. marginal high school graduate kind of humans. That's who they are, and not very sophisticated. The average robbery, this isn't a burglary, this isn't a theft where somebody sneaks into your house. This is a robbery where somebody holds a gun in your face, or they hold a gun in somebody's face at a 7-Eleven, et cetera, where there's an interaction between the victim and the perpetrator. The average robbery has a planning time of less than 2 minutes. Okay, there's basically no plan. They're not thinking through the consequences of the actions very effectively. These are not very sharp knives in the drawer. And so that's most of, and incidentally, the second factor that's critical to understand is that almost all this behavior is men. And the reason why that is the case is that men are essentially in a bind to try to get resources for women. So criminal behavior is largely directed at not very smart men who do not have very good skills to compete in the world economically. And as a result, what they do is they do risky sorts of behavior in order to impress females or to get resources to impress females and therefore compete sexually in the mating pool, you know, and remove a disadvantage that they are experiencing from having less resources than the average male. So that's the, of course, you know, this is a broad brush, and that's not going to be the case in every single case. But if there was a single explanation that would help people understand what is going on inside the criminal mind is not so fascinating and devious and dangerous and exciting and complex. No, that may be true of a Ted Bundy or a Kenneth Bianchi, Hillside Strangler. There are psychopaths, extremely dangerous psychopaths, that can be very intelligent, and they are extremely rare. This is not typical of human nature. What the typical criminal is low conscientiousness, disagreeable, okay, not extremely so, low conscientious, disagreeable, and stupid. And those three characteristics form a triumvirate of an algorithm that basically says your best option to get resources to impress females is going to be to break the rules. And that's what they do.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so there's really no, is there any chance to rehabilitate them?
Yeah, this is sort of the liberal joke. Okay. If you have people that, first of all, we're not going to cure low intelligence. We're not going to stop that. So that's not going to change somebody's 24-year-old and low intelligence. There is no program to improve that intelligence. So that's out. Okay. The low conscientiousness, we're not going to improve the low conscientiousness because that's genetic. And we're not going to make them more agreeable. So that's not going to work either. So we're not actually going to change these people's personality through any mechanism. Now, obviously, one of the most useful things that we could ever do would be to, in a way that we could address this on a societal basis, but we don't, of course, because we've got some mistaken understanding about human nature, and it seems like it's a nice misunderstanding, but it's actually brutally expensive, and causes a considerable amount of the criminal behavior that we have. We should not be wasting public education dollars on people that we're going to, quote, give them an equal education and have them learning, you know, American history in the 10th grade and then learning algebra because they got to do that to pass their high school exam. That is insane. These people that are going to prison could not pass those classes. And so they limp their way through or they drop out. But the truth is, what they need to be learning is a skill. So by the eighth grade, they would be most appropriate for them to be directed towards skill development that would actually make them possible to actually make a living with skilled labor as opposed to unskilled labor. And so the last thing they need to be doing is trying to compete for a limited number of unskilled labor jobs. That doesn't make any sense. That's a prescription for poverty and a prescription for desperation and then therefore criminal behavior on the part of low conscientiousness, low intelligent young men. So instead, what we ought to be doing is having programs that early in the game, they are directed towards things that they can learn that are actually marketable. That would be, an industry should be involved, all this sort of stuff. So now you have Doug Lyle's pie-in-the-sky ideas about how the world should work. But I have seen many young men who at 25 years old, 30 years old, are doing desperate, stupid criminal behavior, and they're really not that bad of people. I mean, they're not great people, but they're not that bad of people. And I had a slew of them in prison. And many of them were doing life sentences behind the absurd concept of three strikes. Just because, you know, baseball had that saying, a bunch of politicians got elected behind that. But it's an absurd idea. So I had one guy that his third strike was, you know, selling marijuana, you know, a few hundred dollars worth of it. And then they locked him up for good. And his previous two strikes were no big deal at all, same kind of behavior. So this is just, you know, political grandstanding on the part of politicians. People do not understand that these criminals are not, quote, all dangerous and sick and that they all are a bunch of animals. This isn't what they are. Mostly what they are is the kid from your high school who wasn't very smart, had a lot of testosterone, has low frustration tolerance, is not a horrible human being, but he's not a great human being either. And if we can put him in a shop, you know, I don't know, making metal buckets or plumbing, or, you know, this is not to denigrate all the trades, but put him someplace where his limited abilities can actually be developed to the point where he can learn some real skill and be productive and make a decent wage, then we have a citizen potentially instead of a criminal. And that's what we should be doing, but we don't under the guise of, you know, everybody could be an Einstein and everybody could be a doctor, which is, of course, totally ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. And so depending on whether or not this guy would be very disagreeable, would he be happy in a trade like that where you teach him a skill and he just continues to be productive?
Lots of guys like that in those trades. Okay. There's a lot of people just like that. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, in work that I did in the real estate industry in construction, there was a lot of guys like that. There's guys that had spent time in prison and, but were good carpenters. And then once they had work, they were perfectly good citizens and hardworking, et cetera. So the notion here is to understand that criminal behavior is all behavior makes sense from the standpoint of gene survival. And so when we stand up and look at criminal behavior from the correct perspective, we understand that that criminal behavior is almost always very understandable cost-benefit analysis on the part of the individual. There's reasons why they're doing what they're doing. Now, there are animals out there, human animals, that are so far off the charts that you would say to me, Doug, let me tell you, this guy, like, cut these people into little bits, and they did this, and they did that, and, you know, what Scott, whatever his name was, that buried, you know, dumped his wife in the bay. You know, there's some pretty nasty psychopaths out there, but those are not typical of the vast majority of criminal behavior that you will see. The vast majority of criminal behavior you'll see is very sort of simplistically calculated cost-benefit analysis that isn't too smart and is somewhat disagreeable and low conscientious. Sometimes it's not even that. One of my favorite guys in prison was a Latino man, and he was the nicest guy in the world, and I wondered what he was in for. And I finally pulled his file, and you know, it was totally reasonable everything that he did. And his third strike, incredibly, was he had a whole bunch of children, and he had his wife, and she used to come and visit him, and he had this three-strike life sentence. It was just a miserable situation. And he was always so easygoing and such a sweet guy, and so I found out what his third strike was. His third strike was when he was out on parole the last time, he and a buddy had backed their truck up to a construction site in the middle of the night and loaded a bunch of wood on there to steal it. Like, well, of course he did. This guy didn't have much in the way of skill. He had a bunch of hungry children. He's trying to be a dad and trying to be a little, you know, a hero and help his family, for God's sakes. What would you expect? And so the notion that is a human that we need to house in the criminal justice system until he dies at 77 years old is insanity. So trust me, those guys exist in there, and I am in no way some bleeding heart liberal about this. There are brutal, incredible human beings in there where we need very thick concrete and electric fences, okay? They're all in there together. And amazingly, it functions. To me, of course, I would be terrified if I was an inmate, but they seem to be able to manage a reasonable detente most of the time. But these guys, there's a lot of guys in there that are very decent human beings who got there through essentially largely either financial desperation or limited stress tolerance behind insults. And their temper got the best of them, and they just don't have that much stress tolerance for taking hits to their ego.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I remember one of the first shows that we did, you were talking about the evolutionary necessity for a male to defend their ego in a village setting.
Yes.
Because if they lose that fight, then they're going to be, it's going to be very expensive in terms of mates.
There's no question. So human males have a chemical that females just can't understand, and it's called dihydrotestosterone. And it's a super rapid testosterone that impacts males to essentially go all in and have this feeling that I don't care what happens, but I'm coming after you because you've insulted me. And so an awful lot of guys are locked up behind an incident where that got activated. And they may have shot at somebody. A few of them have shot people. Most people that are in prison have not killed somebody, and they haven't been particularly brutal. There are those individuals, but I always have to say this, there are some really bad people in there that we are really glad that we have a way to humanely sequester them. But there's an awful lot of perfectly decent people in there that are no different than the guy that is working on your car, or the guy that you run into at the hardware store, or the guy that's painting your neighbor's house. There's an awful lot of blue-collarish level, pretty decent human beings in there that in their young lives usually took a path behind some desperation and some limited stress tolerance and are paying prices for it, as they should. But we have failed them in preparing them for the adult world.
Wow. Very interesting perspective. It's always nice to hear the evolutionary psychology perspective for criminal behavior, because like you said, when it's crystal clear, behavior makes sense. And a lot of the pop psychology I've heard, it doesn't quite hit all the buttons.
Right. Yeah. Here's the story that you'll hear. Oh, Johnny came from a broken home. And Johnny, you know, and this is what happened, and that's what happened, et cetera. The truth is that what's happening in their young life is not shaping their character. What's happening in their young life is they're under stresses from whatever the circumstances are. But believe me, there's Johnnies that they didn't come from a broken home. They broke it. Johnny could break any home, okay? So but the truth is what counts now is what happens to Johnny when he's 14, 15, 16. And he's starting to enter the problems of reproduction. And so now he's having to compete to get resources in order to bring those resources and lay them at the feet of females. That's fundamentally the problem that he's up against. And for males that are sufficiently open to experience and disagreeable and have low conscientiousness, drug dealing and the dangerous sides of drug dealing, you know, make a whole heck of a lot of sense to do that. And so they do that. And as a result, you know, you wind up, because we've made the drugs illegal, we wind up with unenforceable contracts between traders. And as a result of that, you wind up with violence and tragedy. So that's an inevitable byproduct of making things illegal. So in the 1930s, that gave rise to Al Capone, inevitably. You know, there was no question. If you made oranges illegal in Orange County, you would wind up with smuggling, law breaking, and a rough element trying to take advantage of essentially super normal prices on the black market, very high profit margins, if they're willing to take those risks. That's a brutal systemic problem that human beings have not solved very intelligently to this point. They've got a lot of preconceived notions about human nature and about how things they ought to run things. So in the future, I believe that in the next, you know, I won't be around to see it, but I believe that over the next couple of hundred years, the understanding of psychology that we now have from the evolutionary perspective will slowly but surely erode the ignorance that exists in the field now. And it's actually happening fairly quickly. A lot of major thinkers now understand the kinds of things that I'm talking about very well, and they speak from very high places, and they're impacting a lot of ears and minds throughout the academic world, and that leaks over into sociology and the law, et cetera. So these ideas, you know, 100 years from now or 200 years from now, will saturate themselves in the system, and we will have a more humane and more accurate understanding of human nature and the problems that human beings naturally have living together. And we will diffuse many of those problems in the same way that we have come a tremendous distance in the last 200 years in terms of how it is that human beings deal with each other, et cetera. So the you can just imagine that we were locking up Alan Turing, for God's sakes, because he was gay, the man that probably did more than anybody else did for winning World War II. So this is human beings evolve an understanding of each other. When that understanding becomes more accurate, it removes distortions that people have. And so this is, you know, one of the reasons why I would like the ideas of evolutionary psychology to be much more widely disseminated, is because it will help countless individuals in the present and in the future to get more just and appropriate use of societal resources and understanding as we move forward into the future.
Fantastic. And speaking of justice as well, one of your videos called The Willpower Paradox describes the evolutionary psychology reason for why some judges grant parole to prisoners versus others, which I guess we'll talk about in another show.
Yes, very interesting that the judges' minds are highly susceptible to fatigue, and that people are not getting a fair shake in the criminal justice system as a result of us putting judges under stresses that are not natural to the species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a couple of shows. And so for the listeners out there, the way we disseminate this information is to share the podcast, share it with your friends, share it with your Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. It's a great way to get this information. So, Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. Great. Love it. Thank you for walking us inside the criminal mind.
All right. It's a pleasure. And we'll talk more about whatever it is that people want to know.
Sounds good. And you can email me with any questions about the show, and we will get it on the air. Have a good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.